Today on Wings, Beyond the Sex Wars. Can this long-time struggle in the women's movement be resolved?
Some of them say they're pro-prostitution, as if it could be that easy. Then there are others who say that prostitution is evil because it contributes to violence against women. It's like prostitutes are just these bodies who are somehow connected to something bad and evil, or something good and on the cutting edge of revolution.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service. Wendy Chapkis has edited anthologies on women in the military, women in the global textile industry, and the politics of appearance. Her new book is Live Sex Acts, Women Performing Erotic Labor. Chapkis addressed the U.S. National Women's Studies Association in June 1998 at a plenary titled Beyond the Sex Wars. Sex Wars refers to an ideological rift in the feminist movement over whether prostitution is primarily a violation of women's human rights or primarily a job category. Chapkis was introduced by Bonnie Zimmerman, the newly elected president of the National Women's Studies Association.
Our topic today, Beyond the Sex Wars, Feminism, Sexuality, and Power in a Commodity Culture, is large, important, and highly ambitious. We have no illusions that we can define the myriad ways in which the relations, forces, and discourses of sexuality, capitalism, oppression, and resistance are played out across the bodies of women. But the role of a session such as this, at a conference such as this, is to engage in the discussions that push our ideas and our actions forward beyond this very limited time and place. I will begin by introducing Wendy Chapkis, whose 10-year research project in Amsterdam and San Francisco culminated in her book, Live Sex Acts, and who will be speaking on some of the defining issues that we need to be considering around this topic. I find Beyond the Sex Wars to be such a profoundly hopeful title. It, for many of us in this room, I'm sure it reflects a deep desire to leave the trenches behind, to stop firing at each other, to acknowledge the awful cost to many of us who have been involved for up to 20 years for some of us in conversations and often fights about sexuality. It seems to me that in order to move beyond, we need to stop for a minute and assess what we've learned and what we need to take with us, and to honor the insights of those who participated on all sides of this debate. I would say the first and most profound lesson is that war is the problem. It's not our differences of perspective, location, or identity. It is the way that we have engaged with those differences. If anyone should still be suffering from the illusion that feminists can reach that great beyond by coming to a final agreement about such divisive issues as prostitution, pornography, transsexuality, or SM, participation in the NWSA sessions that have dealt with these topics over the last few days should have disabused us of that. I know that Sheila Jeffries, Kathy Miriam, and others are never going to agree with me on issues of prostitution, for instance. I am just convinced we're never going to find that moment where we go, oh, right, I totally agree with you. It's not going to happen. But the style in which our disagreements are expressed must change. The future of our movement is at stake. The very description of this plenary apparently was a charged issue, and I was really delighted when I got in the mail a redrafted description. I don't know what the original was, but the redraft made clear that the intent of this plenary was that it would be, and this is a quote, a thorough and probing discussion of a complex web of issues, and not a debate.
The language emphasized learning from each other across our institutional and political differences, sex workers and activists, academics, all of us holding a range of views on sexuality, commercial and otherwise. We were asked to, quote unquote, deconstruct the binary, that is, to refuse the impulse to see either or as exhaustive options in response to a complex set of issues. In short, the description of the Beyond the Sex Wars plenary, at least as it was revised, calls for a particular approach to differences, not a debate, but a conversation, not a battle, but a mutually engaging sharing of experience and different perspectives. This is a move to a place beyond war, not a place beyond difference. Indeed, it seems to me that the most promising possibility and the most urgent necessity of our time in general is exactly that attempt to refuse war as a strategy for dealing with difference. We must learn to disagree with each other without turning disagreement into a battlefield and the parties to it into enemies. To get beyond the sex wars, we don't have to reach easy agreement between the sides or to create some kind of synthetic integration of positions. Maybe neither is possible. But what is necessary is to go beyond entrenched, fundamentalist, purist positions that rely exactly on purity of perspective, identity, tribe, politics. Purity is alarming to me. Purity resists indisputable diversity. Purity is the real enemy. It sustains borders and it creates border guards. It requires strategies of cleansing and retrenchment. It creates and sustains binaries. Now, as I said, the cost of this war has been enormously high to many of us in this room quite personally and to our movement as a whole. We have reduced each other and each other's ideas to one-dimensional stick figures. And for those of us who've been working specifically on the issue of prostitution, that has also often meant reducing sex workers to very one-dimensional symbols. One of the women that I interviewed for my book, Live Sex Acts, who worked as a teenage street prostitute fleeing an abusive father, complained, "When I read some of the stuff by so-called feminist allies, it feels like they're fighting over our bodies. Some of them say they're pro-prostitution, as if it could be that easy. Then there are others who say that prostitution is evil because it contributes to violence against women. It's like prostitutes are just these bodies who are somehow connected to something bad and evil or something good and on the cutting edge of revolution. They just turn us into symbols." Sex workers, like the feminists fighting over them, are far more complex than any simple position, pro or anti, can define. But in war, we need simple victims, heroes, and enemies. Too often, we as researchers seek stories that reaffirm our positions and that attempt to discredit the positions of those we disagree with. Carol Queen, who is a writer and a sex worker in California, told me, quote, "If a researcher or therapist only encourages someone to look at the down and difficult side of sex work without asking any questions about what feels healthy and vibrant and alive about it to you, they're going to get a very partial story. And by the end of the interview, the sex worker is going to be saying, you know, I never put into words how awful this is. I could give that interview too, except I would have to interrupt myself after every answer to say, but I've also had an experience that contradicts the one that you asked me about." In a similar vein, a Norwegian street prostitute named Elizabeth, who was interviewed for a very anti-prostitution text, Backstreets, by Cecilia Højgaard and Liv Finstad, applauded their account of her experience, which was, as I say, a very anti-prostitution, very critical account of prostitution. But she cautioned, "Everything is always double. At least for me, what you've written is true. But imagine being so divided that you write with two pens and you speak with two tongues." That, it seems to me, is profoundly honest and in some very profound way hopeful. If feminists could follow that lead of recognizing that everything is always at least double, we might be able to create a women's movement for the new millennium that does not insist on simple and pure and singular truth, on adherence to a rigid party line, to fighting one another rather than moving forward together. Another cost of the war between feminists over sex is that we have sometimes been quicker to form alliances with those who are expressly anti-feminist than with other women in the movement, because those alliances with the right, with the church, with libertarians, seem expedient in the moment, in the context of a narrowly defined battle over pornography and prostitution. And I want to read briefly a section from my book about an experience I had on that subject. In the early 1990s, or maybe late 1980s, there was a workshop on pornography organized at the National Organization for Women's annual conference in New York. One presenter, a male academic, reported on the causal relationship that he believed to exist between pornography and violence against women. After the presentation, an audience member approached him. "Isn't there some way," she asked, "to educate people about the differences between violence and consensual fantasies, something besides resorting to censorship? Maybe SM photos could be captioned, 'This is a negotiated fantasy between two consenting adults.'" The man slowly shook his head. "I understand your concern, but while that might be enough for you or me, what about a group of black teenagers at a newsstand on 42nd Street? They won't read or understand a message like that." Overhearing this exchange, I found myself wondering about the problematic alliances some women have made with good, white, professional men out to protect the sisterhood from bad, black, and poor men. But I was soon reminded that my own alliances can be no less embarrassing. The group I was associated with at the conference, Union Labia, Sex Workers and Sex Radical Feminists, had a number of male supporters attached to it. Some of them were fans of the various high-profile porn stars in the delegation. The presence of these men made me acutely uncomfortable, but the pros simply treated them with the cursory courtesy they offered to Johns. One man, however, received a more respectful sort of attention. He was a short, chubby, middle-aged fellow in a business suit. This man, I learned, was no average John. He was a journalist on assignment with Playboy magazine, hoping to cover a catfight between sex workers and now feminists. Playboy had access to our group because the Playboy Foundation had contributed a small sum toward the airfare necessary to bring an international prostitution expert from the World Health Organization in Geneva to the meeting. In return, he was to see if there was a story to be had. I was profoundly uncomfortable with his presence. While pornography may no longer be the declared enemy for feminists such as myself, Playboy's fondness for airbrush perfection has never endured them to me. Throughout the conference, the Playboy reporter secreted himself away with one or another of the Union Labia members, attempting, I assumed, to dig up dirt that wasn't being publicly thrown. I managed to avoid him until the final afternoon. He opened our conversation with the offer of a marijuana cookie. Our alliance as outlaws thus cemented, I proceeded to give him my standard feminist critique of both the anti-pornography, anti-prostitution movement and of the male violence that inspires it. This is a familiar role for me in sex worker, sex radical settings where there are already many articulate voices articulating women's right to fuck convention by being sluts and whores. Because I was talking to a playboy, it felt especially satisfying to remind him that anti-porn feminists were responding to a very real state of emergency over women's sexual integrity and safety. Still, I confided to him, their insistence that people like me are the enemy is disturbing, especially in this political moment when we so desperately need each other. We have to form a united front against real and declared enemies. "Like who?" he asked. "Well, you know, like the president, the Supreme Court, the whole Reagan-Bush right wing." "Now, wait a minute," he interrupted. "What makes you think they're the enemy? I'm a contributor to National Review. William Buckley's a personal friend. They've been very receptive to my articles defending free speech and pornography." I felt the room shift slightly, and it wasn't just the marijuana kicking in. This whole encounter reminded me that anti-pornography feminists have no monopoly on courting or tolerating the support of dubious allies to advance the cause. Now, this anecdote brings me to a crucial recommendation for how we can get beyond this bloody, awful war. That is to be self-critical and to learn to re-engage our sense of humor and perspective about ourselves and about those we disagree with. Learning how to critique our own excesses, our own shortcomings, is ever so much more attractive than hammering on each other. I would also recommend that we read each other's work, and for those of us who are in the classroom, to teach each other's work with an eye for what is smart as well as for what is wrong. In this way, we can learn to listen with less hostility and model for our students how to engage respectfully with texts with which we disagree. We're also likely to learn something that might help us to change our preciously held positions, and that in turn will help us with our efforts to be self-critical. We should also develop a genuine respect and tolerance for diversity within feminism. It's a strength, not a weakness of our movement. No one has a copyright on the title feminist, and no one has a monopoly on the truth. This attitude will be greatly facilitated if we let go of a good measure of our self-righteousness and accept that all of us in this room care passionately about the well-being of women. We have to attempt to find points of commonality and extend a hand of solidarity across our differences on sex. There are so many shared goals that we can work together to achieve if we can do that. And I'll come back to some of those shared goals in a minute. Even on the limited issue of sex, even on commercial sex, there are points of agreement, moments of contact between the sides. I think all of us, whether we're working toward the abolition of prostitution or we're focused on securing sex workers' rights and respect for those in the trade, agree that current attitudes towards women working in the sex industries leads to tremendous violence enacted on them by clients who believe that a whore deserves whatever she gets, by police who treat sex workers like trash that need to be swept up and locked away. Remember, over 100,000 women are arrested each year in this country for prostitution. Listen for a minute to the words of one California sheriff that I interviewed about his attitudes towards what he called whores, quite proudly. "Oh, you can call them anything you like and use all kinds of nice terms, but it doesn't change anything. It's like an interrogation where you say, why do you take things? You don't say, why do you steal? Steal shocks the conscience, so you minimize the language. That's all you're doing by calling people sex workers. It may minimize it in somebody's eyes, and they can say, I'm doing this wonderful job, but they're charging outrageous prices." My rejoinder was, "The women? Sure, I mean, if they're really that benevolent, why would they charge such outrageous prices for their services?" Well, you could ask that of a lot of professionals. Psychotherapists charge a lot of money too, and we assume they're benevolent. "Yeah, but at least they have some schooling and training, and there's some science behind it. I don't know that there's any great science behind what they're doing in the massage parlors. Calling it a profession is a bunch of crap. I think most people define as professional where study and effort are put forth. Having sex is no great accomplishment, I don't think. It's like saying when you have breakfast, you're a professional breakfast eater. But you might be called a professional cook if what you do is cook breakfast for someone else. No, but just eating breakfast would make you a professional. I don't think that sex workers are just having sex. They're performing sex. They're doing something. You don't think that's true?" "No," he laughed at me. "No, do you?" Now, I don't think there's a feminist in this room that wouldn't object to Sheriff Noren's attitudes towards women working in prostitution. And changing attitudes like that, changing attitudes towards sexual women in general, seems to me that it should be a shared goal that could unite us. In the Netherlands, where I did comparative research for Live Sex Acts, prostitution is decriminalized, and sex workers are organized in something like an informal union called the Red Thread. One task that the Red Thread engages in is attempting to re-socialize the public and the police to get them to understand that prostitute women, like all women and like all workers, deserve respect. One of the women I interviewed, Marianne, had worked for many years at the very bottom of the sex trade in Amsterdam, that is, as a heroin whore on the streets of the city. She's a staff worker now at the Red Thread. And she said, "I have very mixed feelings about prostitution. I work for the Red Thread, and I try to make sure that prostitution is treated with the same kind of respect as any other kind of profession. But I certainly can't portray it all in glowing terms. That would be dishonest. It was awful for me. Still, the Red Thread is doing something really important by putting out the message that there's nothing wrong with being a whore. That's one of the reasons I go talk to the new cadets at the police academy. I think if they hear my story and have a face and a name to attach to it, they might start to see sex workers differently. Last time I went to talk to the cadets, I ended my talk by asking how they would feel if someone they knew told them that she was a whore. One student said something like, 'After hearing you talk, I would feel honored, because it's really clear that you could get a bad reaction.' Imagine how different it would be if I came across a cop like that at work. At least this new generation will have met me and know that whores aren't stupid. We really are the authorities on our own lives." I think that's probably one of the most crucial messages that has come out of the sex debates for me, is that women working in the sex trades really are the authorities on their own lives. But the problem is, they don't tell one story. Sex workers tell stories of victimization, slavery, survival, stories of being sexual renegades and rebels, stories of being working women. Sometimes the same woman will tell all of those stories. And each of those stories has its own integrity and its own truth. Another profound insight of the feminist sex debates for me has been that sex itself defies simplistic positions. It's at once a realm of intense violence and exploitation, as well as one of creative subversion. It's an arena of work and negotiation, and a world of abuse and violation. And sex is a terrain of pleasure and exploration. All of those things are true of commercial sex and of non-commercial sex, as contradictory and complex as that sounds. No single position with a bumper sticker-sized slogan can capture that, and neither can our movement. I think that the sex wars have also taught us an enormous amount about sexual representation, about the problem of women being reduced to sexual objects, and also the power of women engaging with sexual representation. I just wanted to mention in passing how disturbed I have been by the attacks on the SUNY New Paltz Women's Studies program for daring to host a conference on women's sexuality called Revolting Women. The right wing took on that program, is still challenging that program, for daring to suggest that women might have something to say about sexuality. I think that that's a fight that we need to take on again as a movement, not as a divided movement, but as one that can support women's right to talk about, to engage with the sexual. Okay, just briefly, I have only 5 minutes left, and I want to suggest some of the ways in which I think we can unite. As I said earlier, the sex wars can never be resolved with any simple assessment of which side won. No side, to reiterate, has a monopoly on the truth. Instead, it seems to me that there's a need for productive conversations across locations from within the sex trades and between those outside of the trade and those inside. The creation of a more complex feminist sexual politics will require us building bridges, not digging deeper trenches, and slinging more mud. At the end of my book, Live Sex Acts, I proposed what I call a hybrid perspective that draws on the strengths of these conflicting accounts without trying to resolve the conflicts between them. First off, for instance, I firmly believe that we need to celebrate the radical feminist insistence that injustice must be challenged and not accommodated. But I also think we need to appreciate the sex radical insight that subversion is a creative ally to opposition. We don't need a politics of just say no. We need to appreciate the abolitionist recognition that simply because something like prostitution seems to have always existed, you know, that old, it's the oldest profession, that it is neither inevitable nor unchangeable. and we need to appreciate the prostitutes' rights reminder that transformation does not reduce to a politics of prohibition or even necessarily abolition. I think that a feminist politics, a prostitution politics that goes beyond war and insists on acknowledging the strengths of these various positions would allow us to redirect our energy to pursue some commonly held goals. And I'd like to just describe three that I think that probably most of us in this room can embrace. The first is a fundamental redistribution of wealth and power between women and men and among women and men. Gross economic disparity between races, sexes, and nations produces conditions of economic coercion and desperation that undermine meaningful choice. And no woman should be forced to engage in prostitution or any other form of productive or reproductive labor against her will. Secondly, I think another shared goal is an organized and empowered workforce. A feminist prostitution politics that honors labor would evaluate politics, policies, and programs on the basis of whether they serve the interests of workers rather than employers or clients. Prostitutes, as all others who labor for a living, should be guaranteed full worker rights, benefits, and respect. And a third goal, and one that's particularly near and dear to my heart as a lesbian and as someone from the state of Maine, where gay rights was just repealed by the citizenry of the state, is a decriminalization of consensual sexual activity and an embrace and respect for sexual diversity. The state should not be in the position of criminalizing adult sexual behavior, whether in the context of loving relationships, recreational encounters, or commercial transactions. Instead, our collective resources should be devoted to teaching respect for sexual diversity and creating conditions under which consent can be made more meaningful. To secure these very, what I admit are very ambitious objectives, we're going to need a broad-based feminist alliance. As Gloria Lockett, who is the director of the African American Prostitutes Education Project in California, insists, "I don't think that until all of us start working together, we're going to change things. No single group by itself can make an impact. We need everybody, street prostitutes and call girls, lesbians and feminists, everybody. We've got to figure out a way to support each other in this." Thank you.
Wendy Chapkis, a sociologist at the University of Southern Maine and author of Live Sex Acts, Women Performing Erotic Labor. Chapkis addressed the U.S. National Women's Studies Association in June of 1998.
Wings is in the process of making all our programs since 1986 publicly available online, along with rare, unedited audio from events like the UN Fourth World Conference on Women. For information, email wings@wings.org. Recent programs are available to download on the website wingsradio.org. And don't miss our daily news feed at facebook.com/wingsradio. Thanks to all our supporters, including your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen and P.J. Abrams, who helped with this show, and especially Genevieve Vaughn, author of the book Forgiving, A Feminist Criticism of Exchange. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. I'm Wings co-founder Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.